or even white books can be worn. Gray flannel, brown suede shoes, yes. When the Duke of Windsor visited the United States by steamship in the 1930s, he arrived wearing a gray flannel suit with brown reverse calf shoes. Now called suede, an elegant brown suede shoe, whether it be monk strap, brogue, cap toe, or even wing-tipped, is appropriate with gray flannel trousers or a gray suit. It is a sophisticated look preferred, along with their enormous tie knots, by the Italians. It just works. Stone's rule number 32. Two-toned shoes and white books, only after Memorial Day. Two-toned shoes, often called spectators, are a classic look from the 1920s and 30s that still work well with a summer suit, as long as the shoe is of the highest quality buck leather or suede. Two-toned shoes draw attention to the feet and look best balanced with a Panama or high-quality straw hat. They are ideal with seersucker cord linen or shantung silk summer suitings in single and double-breasted styles. Frank Nitti wore them. So did Ronald Reagan and Gary Cooper. Adolph Menjou wore them. So did David, the Duke of Windsor. Under no circumstances, however, should they have been worn at any time, even Halloween, except between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Stone's rule number 33. A black suit should only be worn by chauffeurs or undertakers. Yes, I know that a lot of the Hollywood types like the black suit for an evening excursion of clubbing, theater, or see-and-be-seen restaurants. I have seen them at the Ivy on Robertson. Black is too flat by itself, and a black suit, white shirt, and black tie will only make you look like a chauffeur, undertaker, or Mr. Smith in The Matrix. That is not to say that a black turtleneck sweater and tight black leather pants with motorcycle boots, a Steve McQueen look, isn't great for guys under 35 looking to get laid. Stone's rule number 34. Tuxedos with notched lapels are for waiters. The tuxedo, which is properly called a dinner suit or evening suit, is a formal and dressy garment. What man doesn't look good in a tux? Best choice are peaked lapels, or better yet, a shawl collar. Both styles are particularly elegant when executed in a double-breasted style by a fine designer like Allen Flusser Custom Clothing in New York. Midnight blue is the truly correct color, as true black has a tendency to look flat, and even dark green under certain lights. Stone's rule number 35. Hang a name on your opponent. Conservative Florida Democratic Senator George Smathers, who was JFK's closest personal friend in Congress, took on Senator Claude Pepper in the Democratic primary for the Senate in 1950. Smathers branded Pepper as Red Pepper, a moniker that stuck when voters learned of his liberal views on foreign affairs and civil rights. Smathers pounded Red Pepper as a friend of Stalin, and, if not a communist, at least a fellow traveler. Dick Nixon took a lesson and branded his Senate opponent, liberal actress and Congresswoman Helen Gehagen Douglas, wife of movie actor Melvin Douglas, the Pink Lady. She was pink right down to her underwear, said Nixon. I learned much about this maneuver from James L. Martin. Jim was a good old boy Florida political operative who engineered the election of conservative Republican Congressman Ed Gurney to the Senate in 1968 over popular former Governor Leroy Collins, a moderate incumbent governor. Liberal Leroy, Martin branded Collins, in the aggressive campaign that accentuated the few liberal stances Collins could be said to have supported. Gurney became the first Republican elected to the U.S. Senate from Florida since Reconstruction. Jim Martin, an understudy of the legendary Richard Viguerie, taught me most of what I know about direct mail advertising and how to communicate a conservative message to donors and activists. The rest I learned from my ex-wife Anne E.W. Stone. Jim and Anne are two of the most brilliant marketers I know. Martin showed in Florida that he knows how to win. In the 2016 presidential race, Donald Trump proved to be a master of this maxim. Who will ever forget Trump's stinging and often hilarious nicknames for his opponents, particularly Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz? Low-energy Jeb and lying Ted sure won't. Neither will crooked Hillary, whose nickname has outlasted her bitter defeat by the wily Trump. Proof positive of the enduring value of this rule. Stone's Rule Number 36. Brown is the color of shit. Yes, Ronald Reagan wore a brown suit, but Reagan's had a micro-thin light blue stripe, looking kind of like the upholstery in a 48 DeSoto. Brown is flat and unflattering for most skin types. It is truly the color of shit. Solid brown suits and brown ties should generally be avoided, unless you are bold enough to match a brown knit tie with a pink button-down shirt and a tiny houndstooth brown suit. In 1966, when Ronald Reagan ran for governor of California, I was 14 years old. I visited and stayed with a maiden aunt in Sacramento so I could volunteer at the Reagan headquarters. Reagan was challenging Governor Edmund G. Pat Brown. We had bumper stickers that said, "If it's brown, flush it." Now that Congressman Adam Schiff is on the scene, this can be adjusted to, "If it's Schiff, flush it." Sometimes you don't have to hang a name on your opponent. Their name does the work for you. And that's no bullshit. Stone's Rule Number 37. To see how a candidate will perform in office, look at their campaign. Winston Churchill noted that the character of a political leader could be evaluated in the rough and tumble of an election campaign. A candidate who is sure-footed, confident, and organized will govern the same way. A candidate who is risk-averse, poorly organized, or intellectually lazy will likewise govern the same way. Candidates who are too rabid for power and can't mask this flaw will surely bring it to any public office they hold. Candidates who have proven their abilities and skills in some other professional realm before they entered politics and do not crave a political position or office in order to be successful make the best leaders. Eisenhower, Reagan, and Trump come to mind. Stone's Rule Number 38. Check out their shoes. The finest custom-tailored suit, or a well-cut, low-cost Italian suit, can both give a sophisticated impression to a would-be client, or in a meeting with a power broker. Nevertheless, the look can be ruined with the wrong footwear. Shoes must be 100% leather or suede. No plastic, no stacked heels, no metal ornaments, except for the horse bit. And these are only acceptable on genuine Gucci loafers. Stick to capped toes, brogues, wingtips, although not at the beach, as Nixon fancied. Traditional Bass-Wegian penny loafers or tasteful light Italian slip-ons of the softest leather are fine. The Peel line of shoes made for Brooks Brothers, for many years, is still the standard of excellence when acquiring affordable, proper, simple, and tasteful gentlemen's footwear. Remember, the lighter the shoe, the more elegant the look. Heavy soles, favored by the Italians, are an artsy look that may fly in the East Village, or Santa Monica, or Geneva, but it won't cut it for business wear, even though some are very well made. Athletic wear is never right in a business situation. Even Jay-Z puts on the custom English tailoring when he is cutting a mega deal. Shoes must be highly polished and in excellent condition. I would never hire a man who was fastidiously dressed but was wearing scuffed shoes. Various shades of brown suede are acceptable for those continental boulevardiers who want a more sophisticated look. Monk straps or side gusset slip-ons are strong with gray flannel. And even pinstripes add a country influence to an in-town look. George Frazier, the famous Boston columnist, said, "How to size a man up? Look down." If you splattered your patent leather evening pumps with mud when going out in black tie, wipe with champagne, not Vaseline. Seriously, Champagne is the best for cleaning when bringing a luster to patent leather. And the best thing is, you can drink it while you're using it to clean the shoes. Stone's Rule Number 39. Wear your cockade inside your hat. Napoleon's partisans would work undercover while wearing a red, white, and blue ribbon cockade that signified their allegiance to the little corporal, who would become emperor. The cockade insignia would be concealed under their lapels and inside their hats, allowing them to readily reveal themselves to other partisans, while still cloaking their activities and their loyalties to the rest of the world. The larger lesson is well taken. Sometimes it is best to cloak your real political intentions, so you are able to accomplish more without being under suspicion. Stone's Rule Number 40. Utilize finishing touches. The well-dressed man knows that finishing touches can impact a gentlemanly tone to one's appearance. The right pocket square, a tattersall waistcoat, vest, deeply pleated gray flannel trousers, a paperclip watch chain, a tasteful pinky ring with the family crest, or a crest you invent for yourself if your family doesn't have one. Now that your foot is in the door and you've made an impression, it's time to capitalize and strike. Stone's Rules Part Number 3. Going on the Attack. Stone's Rule Number 41. Attack, attack, attack. Never defend. This was the credo of the late Murray Chotiner, one tough Jew who was the real Jedi master of negative attack politics. Chotiner made Earl Warren governor of California and put Bill Noland in the Senate. But most importantly, he was eminence grise for Congressman, Senator, Vice President, and President Richard Milhouse Nixon. Operating in the days before television, Chotiner refined and perfected the modern negative campaign, relentlessly attacking his opponents in flyers, radio commercials, voter mailings, and telephone calls. Murray and his brother were both lawyers, representing dozens, if not hundreds, of mid-level hoods and gunsels throughout the 1950s and 60s. Nixon White House Chief of Staff H.R. Bob Haldeman observed that Chotiner had the nerves of a cat burglar. When dealing with a sticky public situation with charges flying, Murray was adamant about the only course of action. 1. If it is necessary to issue a denial of charges leveled against you, do it quickly, and only do it once. 2. Avoid repeating the charges, anywhere, ever. 3. Counterattack with greater ferocity. Stone's Rule Number 42. Let no attack go unanswered. Bill Clinton recognized that every attack must be answered. But this is not the same as launching a defense, which would violate Murray Chotiner's rule of attack and never defend. Any attack must be answered only as an element of a devastating counterattack. Be careful not to repeat the charge in full or in any detail. It is never wise to educate that portion of the voters who have not yet heard the scurrilous charges against you. In this age of the Internet and 24-hour cable news networks, of instant information, news travels quickly, so rapid response is a 24-hour-a-day task and a critical element to have securely in place, ready to go at a moment's notice. A campaign without such a mechanism is doomed. Stone's Rule Number 43. Plan your work, work your plan. I learned this from the legendary Frank Haig, the boss of Jersey City in Hudson County, New Jersey. Frank, I am the law, Haig, ran the city and county with an iron fist, assiduously addressing the political concerns of the Irish, Italians, Poles, Hungarians, African Americans, and a smattering of Puerto Ricans, whose votes Haig controlled. Haig was a legendary planner who worked each of these ethnic constituencies with patronage and, for those who were recalcitrant, muscle. Have a plan. Work your plan every day. every hour, every minute you are not sleeping. And when you are asleep, dream about your plan and how you can better work it. Don't be afraid to change it when circumstances change. Stone's Rule Number 44. Write it down. In the Nixon White House, any aide summoned to the office of Chief of Staff H.R. Bob Haldeman, who didn't bring a pad with him, was summarily fired. Whether it is on an old-school yellow legal pad or a personal electronic device of any sort, make a list of your tasks. If you prefer to go the traditional route with a pad, be sure to carry a fine leather jotter in your inside breast pocket. Revise and review your task list every day. Be relentless in your follow-up. Cross off action items from your list as you complete them. Zero defects, as Haldeman demanded. Let nothing fall through the cracks. Stone's Rule Number 45. Plans are worthless. Planning is indispensable. Eisenhower said it. Candidates or clients who demand ornate written plans for an advertising and public relations or electoral military campaign don't understand that life is not a static process, and that any written plan would have to be amended as circumstances swiftly change, making the written plan time-consuming and ultimately useless. Leadership is adaptive according to changing circumstances, and thus decision-making must be somewhat ad hoc. Franklin Roosevelt, whose biography by Lord Conrad Black, a rogue of the First Order, I like, had no plan when he vowed to bring America back from depression. FDR improvised a series of ad hoc decisions and initiatives that brought back America's confidence and ultimately her strength. Roosevelt had setbacks, like the defeat of his effort to expand the Supreme Court. Knowing what direction you want to head is about tactics. Knowing what you want to achieve is a clearly defined goal. Having a strategy to get there is crucial. Inviolable plans are worthless. Planning, on the other hand, knowing ahead of time how you will cross a river and how long it will take if the time to cross the river should come, is a different thing entirely. Logistical planning is crucial. Stone's Rule Number 46. Attack your enemy on many fronts. To vanquish an enemy at war, or to win a political campaign, you must attack your opponent on many fronts. Your opponent must be and feel not only besieged, but also confused and demoralized. Superior planning and lightning speed in the thrust of your attacks will dominate the race, put your opponent off balance, and cause them to make errors, only compounding your opportunities to attack them again and again. Open many fronts. Force your opponent to fight every battle, and you will win the war. Stone's Rule Number 47. The Big Lie Technique. Erroneously attributed to Nazi propaganda chief Joseph Goebbels, the big lie manipulation technique was actually first described in detail by Adolf Hitler himself. Though it would be convenient to characterize it as Nazi self-revelation, the truth is that Hitler was using it to describe what he called Jewish calumny, among other things. Nonetheless, the tactic of creating a lie so bold, massive, and even so monstrous that it takes on a life of its own is alive and well all through American politics and news media. Make it big. Keep it simple. Repeat it enough times, and people will believe it. This big lie technique is precisely how the Democrat Party and its mainstream media handmaidens reacted to the 2016 election and the improbable defeat dealt them by Donald J. Trump. The media's mindless, yet endless insistence that the Russian state helped Donald Trump win, along with the completely bogus claims that Julian Assange is a Russian agent, and that I received supposedly hacked emails from WikiLeaks and then passed them to Donald Trump and the Trump campaign, is truly the biggest lie of the century. The reality is that the Democrat-contrived Russia-Trump collusion hoax has at its core nothing more than a wishful left-wing conspiracy theory inflated, exploited, expanded, and repeated over and over and over for nearly 2 years. Yet still, these partisan media hacks and their fellow Democrat deception artists in Congress produced absolutely zero evidence to substantiate any of their defamatory insinuations, or to justify the false, misleading distraction all this has been to American political life. But then, was this not really the whole point of it? To distract, divert, defame, delay, and ultimately destroy President Trump and the progress he has been making on so many fronts. The deranged talking head pygmies at MSNBC, the effete snobs at Salon, Daily Beast, Vice, and other leftist propaganda fronts shamelessly peddled this garbage, without the slightest intention of ever producing any actual evidence to back up any of their cacophonous din of aspersions, disguised as speculative reporting. Of course, this mass journalistic malpractice is supplemented by a veritable army of online trollbots, directed by America's sleaziest trollbot of all, the repugnant Clinton mercenary David Brock, head of the subversive Media Matters. Brock runs what is an industrial-grade disinformation operation that exists solely to reinforce their big lie. Stone's Rule Number 48. Work it from every angle. I believe in a belt and suspenders, at least when it comes to getting your campaign message out. When communicating a message in today's media diversity, you must wage your campaign in every medium, looking for the pickup that will catapult your message to a greater audience to achieve your public relations and political messaging goals. People often ask me which medium is most important today. Social media, television, mailers, etc. My answer is simply all of them. When getting your message out to the world, leave no stone unturned, pun intended. Stone's Rule Number 49. The key word in choosing your wardrobe is appropriate. Knowing when and where to attack your enemy is just as important as dressing for the activity you'll be engaged in. For instance, don't wear moderate shorts at a wedding, and don't show up in a tuxedo for bowling. Never wear athletic wear any place other than a gym, or while engaged in some organized outdoor sport. Never go shopping dressed in athletic wear. Salespeople will assume you're penniless, and the service will suck. Don't be afraid of iconic items such as buttery soft Gucci loafers and an Hermes belt. Stone's Rule Number 50. Mix patterns, but not purpose. Clothing is either formal, casual, or sports-oriented. These elements of dress cannot be mixed. A dark navy blue double-breasted suit requires a starched cutaway or long point collar, a small patterned tie, colors to the taste of the wearer. But button-down collars or sports shirts won't mix, the only exception being the black cashmere turtleneck, which, let's face it, is so cool it can be worn with anything. Button-down shirts, khaki slacks, ribbon belts, and Basswegian penny loafers are casual attire that can be dressed up or down with a necktie, but never appropriate for business. Stone's Rule Number 51. Casual dress does not excuse you from good taste. First of all natural fibers, cotton, linen, wool are acceptable. Khakis, chinos, polo shirts, solid colored t-shirts. Synthetic blends of any kind are unacceptable, except in socks where it's needed for resiliency. Shorts should be khaki, black, navy blue, seersucker, or madras, and should fall just above the knee. Hot pants are never acceptable for men who are not in drag. Shorts are never worn with a sports coat or blazer, unless vesting Bermuda. Esquire correctly points out that the closest a man should come to denim shorts is helping a lady out of them. Dress khakis up with a blazer and down with a t-shirt. Sports jerseys are for professional athletes. If you aren't one, don't wear one. Rugby shirts are for guys under 40. Ribbon-style belts and watch bands can prep up a look and give you a break from highly polished leather belts and braces, known in the U.S. as suspenders, and should never be clip-on. Hats with any team or tractor company logo will mark you as a country fuck, as Eddie Murphy said in 24 Hours. Stone's rule number 52. Don't get mad. Get even. If you have never been screwed over, one way or another, you have never operated in real-world politics. For many political creatures, screwing over others is an art form, if not a second career. Franklin Lynn Nofziger, Ronald Reagan's longtime press secretary and fiercely loyal political aide, would get even with anyone he felt was hurting the Gipper. Reagan biographer Lou Cannon wrote that the disheveled Nofziger looked like a wax pear that sat on the radiator too long. During a briefing for Reagan delegates in 1976, one of us asked what our demeanor should be on the floor. Nofziger replied, "The demeanor, de better. Always be ready to display ferocity, but never true anger. The reality is that anger distracts and can cause even the coolest of politicians to make mistakes, sometimes big ones." Richard Nixon would rage against his opponents and issue orders, some even illegal, to Chief of Staff Bob Haldeman. An experienced Nixon hand, Haldeman knew not to act on any of it, as Nixon would reverse himself once he cooled off. As a genuine emotion, anger is wasteful and enervating, but as a purposeful planned tactic, a well-placed show of anger can work wonders. Done right, it is a surefire way to instill fear in the weak and garner respect from anyone foolish enough to have underestimated the consequences of crossing you. Pulling the full Sicilian, a sudden explosion of unbridled, towering rage, should be as coldly calculated as it is terrifying, even destabilizing, to whoever is unlucky enough to be on the receiving end of it. I used to practice in front of a mirror how to make the veins on my forehead pop out as a finishing touch to my out-of-control Italian routine. A true pro knows that getting even with an opponent who stuck it to you almost never happens when the sting of being screwed over is most profound. The cool-headed, well-seasoned political operator knows how to take even the worst screw job in stride and immediately begin channeling and focusing the energy of a burning anger into the task of devising an exquisitely devastating payback that will make the screwing you received look like a Sunday picnic by comparison. The satisfaction you'll feel when you settle a righteous vendetta against some deserving but unsuspecting schmuck who thought they walked away scot-free after plunging a knife in your back is an exhilaration worth every bit of the steely discipline you have to summon to quickly and calmly move past the inevitable slings and arrows of outrageous political fortune. Stone's rule number 53. Go for the bank shot. When Senator Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in June 1968, liberal New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller appointed moderate Republican Congressman Charles Goodell to the Senate seat left vacant by Kennedy's death. Senator Goodell's son, Roger, is currently commissioner of the NFL. For the next 2 years, Goodell moved hard left, becoming one of the Vietnam War's most vocal critics. This drove President Nixon nuts, perhaps more so than the same criticisms coming from any anti-war Democrat. When the seat came up for election in 1970, Goodell sought to win it in his own right. He faced two opponents. One was New York Conservative Party nominee James L. Buckley, brother of conservative icon and National Review founder William F. Buckley, Jr. The other was multimillionaire Democrat Congressman Richard L. Ottinger, who, like Goodell, was also a prominent critic of the war in Vietnam. As the campaign closed in on election day, it appeared Democrat Ottinger would defeat both Buckley and Goodell. That is, until Nixon dispatched Vice President Spiro Agnew to New York to savagely attack the embarrassingly liberal Republican Goodell. Thanks to the Republican Vice President's sustained rhetorical bludgeoning of his own party's U.S. Senate candidate, the anti-war vote ended up being redistributed between Ottinger and Goodell. enough liberal anti-war voters migrated from Ottinger to Goodell that Buckley was able to squeeze past both men and win one of New York's U.S. Senate seats, denying it to both major political parties. Sometimes you gotta use the bank shot. Stone's rule number 54. Hate is a stronger motivator than love. Only a candy ass would think otherwise. People feel satisfied when there is something they can vote for. They feel exhilarated when there is something or someone they can vote against. Just ask President Hillary Clinton about all of the people who rushed out to vote for her. The unfortunate but hard reality is that few people actually vote their hopes and aspirations. Modern American politics have seen few figures who attracted voters with an upbeat and optimistic message, convincing Americans that there was no limit to what America could do, while weathering the typical barrage of attacks from their opponents. John Kennedy was one, with the youthful vigor of his new frontier. Ronald Reagan clearly revived a moribund Jimmy Carter malaise weary country with his soaring confidence in America as that shining city on a hill. There is no question that Donald Trump's central campaign theme was the most positive and upbeat since Reagan, to make America great again. Trump stands with only Kennedy and Reagan in this stead. Sorry to those who think Barack Obama was elected because his campaign was somehow distinctly positive, or even that his message was the key to his success. You are being as phony as your dear leader if you hew to this myth. The Obama campaign was certainly awash in slick reproductions of pre-World War II National Socialist propaganda art themes, loaded with highly generic, to the point of being utterly meaningless buzzwords. But Obama did not rise on his message, and he most certainly did not have to weather any of the typical types of sustained assaults from his opponent or opponents that every other previous presidential candidate faced, and that made their ultimate victory a genuine feat, as was the case with Kennedy, Reagan, and Trump. While Trump's core message was uniquely inspirational, with the country coming off of the saccharine empty high of a technocratic pseudo-messiah, Trump was also the beneficiary and an extraordinarily deft amplifier of a deep and frankly much-deserved loathing for Trump's dour and shrill opponent in 2016. Trump perfectly epitomized how being an upbeat, inspiring cheerleader as a candidate in no way means not also being a hard-hitting brawler when necessary, especially when the chips are down. A winning candidate knows how to be a harsh critic without being perceived as a nasty curmudgeon. John McCain knows how to land a great zinger and has an acerbic wit. The problem is that McCain became known as more cranky curmudgeon than magnanimous, albeit caustically witty, candidate. Do-gooders and disingenuous leftists who decry the politics of fear and negativism are simply denying the reality of human nature and only fooling themselves. Emotions cannot simply be erased or ignored, and to believe they can is a suicidally naive approach to political competition. Voters may superficially tell pollsters and pundits how turned off they are by all of the negative campaigning. But the reality is that voters are entertained and often riveted by attack politics. Donald Trump transformed it into nearly an art form in 2016. And it was a key ingredient, if not the key ingredient, of his stunning victory. The same people who tell you they hate negative political TV commercials will also be able to tell you exactly what was in them. A political strategist's job is to exploit negative but memorable ads for the purpose of winning votes. The trick is in being able to engage in negative campaigning without being successfully cast or widely perceived as running a negative campaign. Understanding the voters' fears, apprehensions, and yes, hatred, is just as critical a part of political messaging as knowing how to appeal to their hopes and aspirations. A campaign that figures out how to do both simultaneously is the most likely to succeed. It was W.C. Fields who said, "Hell, I always vote against, never for." Stone's rule number 55. Always praise 'em before you hit 'em. This technique was one of Dick Nixon's best. The veteran political pugilist would praise his opponent's sincerity and commend the opponent's genuine belief in what are, nonetheless, terrible ideas and repugnant ideologies. Praise him before you hit him makes the hit seem more reasonable and even-handed, and thus more effective, said the trickster. My friend Hubert Horatio Humphrey is a sincere liberal. I have the utmost respect for the depth of Senator Humphrey's belief in creating a more socialized America, Nixon would say. Stone's Rule Number 56. He who speaks first loses. I had a cousin on my mother's side who was in the vegetable business. He grew tomatoes, peppers, and cucumbers in South Jersey. Every morning at 5 a.m., he would drive his produce to an open-air market in Philadelphia, where he would sell his vegetables at that day's going rate. You never tell them what you want for your cucumbers until they tell you what they are paying for cucumbers, or you'll leave money on the table, my cousin told me. I don't sell my cucumber until I know what a client wants to pay for it. Stone's Rules, Part Number 4. How to Win in Politics. Stone's Rule Number 57. Losers don't legislate. Politics is about winning, not going down with your flags flying. Voters should not be viewed monolithically, but broken down into various groups who respond to various appeals. Politics is about meticulously expanding your group, not about ideological purity or taking your last stand on the last hill. If your base is happy 100% of the time, it only proves that you are not reaching out for new voters and are stagnating on your own turf. Learn how to stretch the limits of your base, but never betray it. Stone's Rule Number 58. Make your message big, bold, and simple. Whenever a young man or woman comes to work for me, I require them to read David Ogilvie's Confessions of an Advertising Man, the second greatest book ever written, after the Holy Bible. A Scottish advertising genius, Ogilvie's principles were used in newspaper, magazine, and TV advertising in the 70s and 80s, with incredible success. They also apply, with equally extraordinary effect, to internet-age messaging. Write great headlines, and you'll have successfully invested 80% of your money, was one of Ogilvie's famous maxims. Ogilvie came from the world of direct response advertising, which used devices like coupons and reply-by-mail campaigns to invoke consumer response. This way, success could be measured on more than just sales figures. Readers can grasp bold ideas and concepts through headlines, and Ogilvie favored the big, bold, stark headline. He believed the key to good advertising was in your offer to voters, which must be immediately discernible in your headline. Telling voters what is in it for them is the best way to grab their attention. Signs and billboards are hit and run. You can only effectively communicate the name of the candidate or cause. If I see a logo without the candidate's name as the largest, most prominent feature, I see a lost opportunity. With internet advertising, your pitch must be long enough to tell a story, but short enough not to lose the reader's attention. David Ogilvie was a madman before madmen showed the world what a madman was. His book revolutionized my ideas about advertising. Read it, learn it, live it. Stone's Rule Number 59. The more you tell, the more you sell. The idea that short advertisements and heavily abbreviated advertising copy are most effective is wrong. I learned this from James L. Martin, the direct mail advertising genius. Martin learned it from Richard Viguerie, the direct mail pioneer who, more than anyone else, figured out how to use direct marketing to rally conservatives and raise millions of dollars in small dollar contributions for conservative causes. The most successful fundraising letter of all time ran to 26 pages and was signed by George McGovern. 30-second TV commercials don't give you much time to sell. 60-second commercials are better, but difficult to buy in prime time. Longer direct mail, newspaper, magazine, and other direct response print advertising invariably outperform shorter copy. Unlike other forms of advertising, the effectiveness of direct response advertising can be measured by the number of orders or contributions garnered by a specific mailing or ad piece. Many of the very best TV and radio writers first cut their teeth in direct response advertising. Attention spans may be short today, but when a reader does opt to engage with focus, having longer, more detailed copy ultimately gives more bang for the buck. Better to have 10% read the longer copy with some real impact than 100% whiz past a short copy ad, none of it sinking in, much less having an impact. Stone's Rule Number 60. Sometimes you've got to turn chicken shit into chicken salad. In politics and in life, you play the cards you are dealt. Sometimes you have to take your greatest disadvantage and turn it into a plus. Lyndon Johnson called it changing chicken shit into chicken salad. When Nixon, who Johnson never had any particular use for and had called the chicken shit, was elected president, LBJ released a statement of obligatory praise for Nixon, as was the custom of that era. When reminded by reporters that he had called Nixon a chicken shit, Johnson said he changed chicken shit into chicken salad. Stone's Rule Number 61. No shades. Candidates should never be filmed or photographed with sunglasses. Dark sunglasses make you look sinister, not sexy like Marcello Mastroianni. Think Giancana, Onassis, and Carmine DiSapio, the legendary boss of the Manhattan Democratic machine. I wear them, but then I'm not running. Stone's Rule Number 62. Ponytails are for men under 30. A bald pate and a ponytail should require the death penalty. This odd look is seen in only three places in America: Los Angeles, New York City, and Atlantic City, New Jersey. I'd embrace my baldness before I wore a Hollywood agent ponytail while going bald. Stone's Rule Number 63. Pay your political debts. In 2000, I went to Miami-Dade County in Florida to work on the presidential recount then underway. I went not because I was a Bush Republican, but because former Secretary of State James A. Baker III asked me to go. In 1981, Baker overruled the White House political shop and secured President Reagan's appearance in a campaign TV commercial for New Jersey gubernatorial candidate Thomas H. Keene. Baker did this at my request and badgering. Keene went on to win by only 1,200 out of 2.5 million votes. I never forgot it. When Baker called me in 2000, the Florida recount had already been fully conducted twice, with no change in results. George W. Bush had won more votes in Florida than Vice President Al Gore. Period. This is now undisputed. Gore's partisans on the ground, directed by Beltway Democrat lawyers, were beginning to methodically and systematically drag out the recount, working to create doubts and cause delay while they litigated and manipulated the process. Pro-Gore actors would have done anything and everything possible to prolong the process and delay any final recount certification for the next 3.5 years if necessary, as long as Gore kept coming up short. Baker told me to shut it down. I thought about the help Baker gave me almost 20 years earlier, before I picked up the walkie-talkie and ordered Republican activists to storm the Miami-Dade County Courthouse, fomenting what became famously known as the Brooks Brothers Riot. The so-called Brooks Brothers Riot prevented Democrats from removing ballots to an area with no observers and halted the recounting of the same ballots for the third time. Given the sneaky Democrat maneuvers, it was justifiable citizen action if you ask me. Paying one's political debts is not only the right thing, it is good business. It may, and typically does, entail doing something you may not like and may not want to do. If it was something easy, it probably wouldn't be a political favor. But politics is assuredly a business in which what goes around comes around. Stone's Rule Number 64. Campaign finance reform, as done for politics, what pantyhose has done for finger-fucking. Money always seeks its own level. What all of our august lawmakers in Congress know is that influence and power always have ready, eager purchasers, whose money will always find a route to its intended power broker, no matter how circuitous. The 1974 post-Watergate campaign finance reforms, some of which were successfully challenged for violating the First Amendment in the U.S. Supreme Court by Senator James L. Buckley of New York, brother of William F. Buckley, and now a distinguished member of the bench, were merely circumvented through party committees and other dodges. The more recent McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, even more ridiculously inhibitive of free speech, was, thank God, functionally circumvented by so-called 527 committees that can express political opinions as long as they are not directly advocating the election or defeat of any candidate. Yes, even Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and Danny Williams, Bill Clinton's abandoned son, have free speech rights. The Citizens United decision leveled the playing field, allowing corporations the same rights as unions. Whatever the next iteration of rules the Beltway masterminds impose, as with all previous attempts, it too will somehow be legally circumvented, because politics thrives on money. Stone's Rule Number 65. Use the Internet to do with thousands of dollars what once required millions. The Internet changed everything in politics by putting public office within reach of modestly financed candidates. Yesterday's era of network TV, as the only outlet for mass communications, had advertising costs in the millions for a congressional race in markets like Los Angeles, New York, Miami, or Dallas, and in the tens of millions for statewide offices. Location and interest profiling of select geo-targeted voters now allows a candidate to communicate far more effectively and cost-efficiently with their target audience. Even a $250,000 ad buy is just a drop in the bucket on network TV. But a $250,000 digital media campaign that employs sound advertising principles and uses finite geopolitical targeting can be a winner, with exponentially more bang for the buck. Raising vast sums of money, or being a millionaire capable of self-funding a campaign to purchase a seat in Congress, like New Jersey's Frank Lautenberg or Wisconsin's Herb Kohl, are no longer prerequisites to winning public office. Now public offices are within the grasp of those not in the permanent political class, or among a small few ultra-wealthy elites. The ability to reach voters electronically, at far less cost than traditional methods, is the most positive development for our republic in at least a century. It has also expanded the impact of millions of special interest dollars, which, for better or worse, can level the playing field in David and Goliath political races, especially against incumbent politicians with lobbyist-loaded political war chests. The democratizing effect of the Internet and unprecedented electoral successes by outsiders against a well-heeled elite ruling class have been profound, particularly for those battling left-wing dominance of mass media. Unfortunately, to counteract this trend, hard-left executives at various tech giants have underhandedly resorted to a most heinous and un-American abuse of their monopolistic control over online information: censorship. Years ago, when everyone was signing on to these new platforms, these companies never disclosed designs to use their unprecedented control over nearly all published information in today's online world as a tool to serve their own narrow political and ideological ends. Once Google, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and other Silicon Valley Internet companies made themselves the dominant, if not nearly exclusive, channels of online information, their true colors as authoritarian ideologues quickly and garishly began to fly. Now, anyone who opposes their political dogma, exposes corruption of power, including their own, or works against their favorite politicians, government schemes, or pet left-wing causes, risks being digitally suppressed, if not eliminated entirely, from the virtual public square. Tech has now been unmasked as the tech left. Their former role as mere silent, unseen facilitators of information platforms in exchange for advertising dollars has been sneakily transformed into that of censors, content minders, political correctness enforcers, and the ultimate arbiters of online speech. Let me be among the first to predict that this will be their ultimate undoing, and that the democratizing essence of the Internet will ultimately take them down, just as it has smashed the death grip that ruling institutional elites had for many decades over access to public office and the political process. Stone's Rule Number 66. Never turn down a major party nomination. When Christine Todd Whitman, daughter of longtime Nixon friend, backer, and Eisenhower intimate Webster Todd Sr., told former President Richard Nixon that she could get the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate from New Jersey against former NBA and then current political superstar Bill Bradley, the old man told her to go for it. "You never know what will happen, and the political atmosphere can change in a second," said the sage of Saddle River, as Nixon came to be known, in dispensing his wisdom from his modest residence in the New Jersey town of that name. Bradley got caught in a Democratic downwash in the fallout of Governor Jim Florio's disastrous tripling of the state's income tax, and just barely topped Whitman in a true squeaker of an election. Whitman had lost, but instantaneously became the odds-on favorite for governor in the following year's race. Whitman took her shot, defeated a former attorney general in the GOP primary, and then, in a major upset, beat the tax-hiking Democrat Florio. No political aspirant can harm their long-term political prospects by becoming a major party nominee for any statewide or national office. Barring any serious gaffes, a truly horrible campaign, or a permanently damaging scandal, even if the candidate loses, they will become a party favorite for the next major office to open up. They will also have gained the invaluable experience of running a full-fledged campaign all the way to the finish line, and unless their loss was an embarrassing blowout, will have a significant fundraising advantage right from the outset of their next bid. On the upside, they may actually win the race. Turning down such an opportunity risks the candidates appearing to be any number of undesirable things, depending on the circumstances. From vain, to craven, to disloyal, to self-serving, to unsure, to unreliable. Even if the candidate had every good reason to sit out the race, if the party is left in a lurch as a result, or has to scramble to find a credible nominee, the party faithful will not soon forget, especially when the candidate comes back around looking for the nomination of their choice. A major party nomination for high office is a prize not to be tossed aside lightly. Do so at your own peril. Stone's Rule Number 67. What's in the public domain is fair game. One weekend in October 1965, almost a year after the defeat of my hero Barry Goldwater, I was taking the commuter train from New Canaan, Connecticut, to New York City to volunteer in National Review founder William F. Buckley's campaign for mayor. I was present when Buckley asked what he would do if he won, said, demand a recount. This was a time when conservatism had fallen into political disrepute. After a year of nonstop maligning by the forces arrayed around LBJ in his re-election, some of which were involved in taking out President Kennedy to clear Johnson's path to power. We were accused of being anti-Semites, Klansmen, red baiters, warmongers, crypto-fascists, and worse. Bill Buckley changed all that. He proved that conservatism could be charming, erudite, intellectual, and cool. Decades later, George Pataki beat Mario Cuomo for governor of New York, running as a tax-cutting conservative. By the end of his second term, Pataki had morphed into an out-of-control spender who had mortgaged the state's future, borrowing through so-called independent authorities to avoid getting all of this borrowing approved by New York voters, as the state's constitution required. Pataki ended up tripling the state's debt. He also passed the strictest gun control legislation in the country, after falsely reassuring gun owners, sportsmen, hunters, and enthusiasts, of which upstate New York has many, that he supported the Second Amendment. He even declined to oppose partial birth abortion, taking a position that is closer to far left than anything resembling conservative thought. In New York State, a candidate can be nominated by more than one party, appearing as the nominee of multiple parties, beyond just Republicans and Democrats. The candidate's cumulative vote total is what matters to victory. But for purposes of distinguishing how much support each party garnered in actual votes, it is possible to break down the vote totals by party nominee. This can prove quite useful, especially in giving leverage to smaller, more ideologically oriented parties that may well have the votes needed to give a major party candidate the necessary margin for victory. I knew Pataki had a lock on the Conservative Party nomination for governor. The party had drifted far from the days when it supplied a counterbalance to the liberal Republican Party of Nelson Rockefeller and Jack Javits. With the gubernatorial race and Pataki in mind, I called Bill Buckley, and he invited me to come by his maisonette for a chat. I shared my thoughts on what a disappointment his fellow Yalee, Pataki, had been. Buckley wholeheartedly agreed. I suggested to Bill that penning his views on the governor in either the National Review or in his own nationally syndicated column would be quite useful. Erudite and brilliant, but nothing of an ivory tower intellectual, Buckley took hometown and home state politics seriously. He ended up writing several scathing pieces on Pataki. When I included Buckley's accurate quotes in mailings to Conservative Party members and leaders, I got an email from Bill that the Conservative Party hierarchy was complaining. Having utmost respect for this founding member of the contemporary conservative political movement in America, and a good friend over many years, I nonetheless replied that Bill's comments had been published, putting them squarely in the public domain and, thus, making them fair game for use elsewhere, including communications to the public in a political race. "Right you are," responded Bill. "Come by for a drink when you are next in New York." Stone's Rule Number 68. A tan makes a man look vigorous, and a deep tan makes a man look prosperous. Aristotle Onassis spent a very large amount of his time cavorting in the sun on his yacht, wearing oversized sunglasses, a gold medal, slicked back hair, and a high-waisted Italian bathing suit, usually accompanied by beautiful women, like Maria Callas and Jacqueline Kennedy, later Onassis. Ari said you can never be too tan. Reagan maintained his tan through his time as a Hollywood star, television host, and governor of California. After a bout with skin cancer, Reagan's sun worship was over. Ever conscious of his appearance, Reagan would drink a small glass of red wine just before a television appearance because he knew it gave him rosy cheeks, which accentuated his Irish all-American appeal. Having looked pale in his first debate with the bronzed JFK, by 1968, Nixon was using a sun lamp at home to have a rosy glow before major TV appearances. Nixon called it home cooking, but was careful to avoid sunburns, using just enough of the lamp's rays to have a healthy glow. There was a tanning product for men at the time called Man Tan, which sadly made you look orange. Today, Clinique, among other high-end brands, makes bronzers for men that will make you look rested, confident, and on top of the world, even if you overimbibed on vodka martinis at Elaine's the night before. I highly recommend owning some. Stone's Rule Number 69. Everything is recycled. Milton Berle once said that there are no such things as new jokes, only old jokes rewritten for the time. Uncle Milty stole more than his share of them. So it is with political ideas. Even innovative ideas borrow from the past. Politics in the United States are not known for public policy boldness. All the ideas today's politicians present to the voters are simply recycled versions of the same basic formulae that have been employed by political hucksters and power-accumulating government careerists.